Today is July 24th, 2022. This is part 33 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Jim Haggart, last name spelled H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Tom. I hope you're doing well.
Very good. Thank you. Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Oh, for certain. Go ahead.
Thank you. Last time we finished up in June of 2016, and I think you'd mentioned that you were back on North Rim in the fall of 2016. Can you pick that thread up?
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's kind of a never-ending saga, is it, right?
So, it's good.
In June of 2016, of course, if you recall, Art and I had tried to do some summits on the North Rim, and, you know, just because it's summertime, June, early June, doesn't mean you can't do anything on the North Rim, but whether it's my, living in Canada making me unused to the heat of Arizona in June or whatever, we had to back off of virtually everything we tried in June. So it was a little bit disappointing at the time, although we managed to get up the Little Dragon. So in October of 2016, we decided to take another crack at some of these North Rim summits. And so the ones we had tried to do in the earlier part of the year included Juno and Jupiter, and then also Elaine Castle and King Arthur and Guinevere out to the west, on the west side of the plateau. And so we figured we'd try and catch these summits on this trip. So that was the plan, and I flew down, as typical, using a buddy pass from Art, and he picked me up at the airport. We went to my mother's, where I picked up the equipment that I store there, and then headed up to Cliff Dwellers for dinner and got a room for the night. So that gave us a good setup for the next day. And so we got up fairly early and headed up onto the plateau and had breakfast at the lodge, Jacob Lake, and then worked our way down the roads on the plateau to essentially the cabin south of Kanabinet Spring, and at that point we parked the car there, and you remember we had been here previously, right? And,
yep.
and drove by there and took a look at the cabin. So we knew the way, the access routes and whatnot. And so we parked the car there and then started down on the hike out to the Galahad Point. And it's just a wonderful walk through the woods. You just can't beat hiking in the North Rim, Ponderosa Pine Forest. I just think it's just such a lovely, lovely place. It's so easy to walk around, you know, and until you get into some New Mexico locust or something like that. But you know, those are usually few and far between, and you can work your way around them in most cases. But we just had a nice walk, and, you know, you just follow the height of land. You have to be aware of where you're walking, of course, because the terrain is not necessarily as sharp, or it's definitely not as sharp and recognizable as it is off the rim. And it's gently rolling and flat with, you know, valleys here and there. And if you don't keep track of where you are, it's easy to get misplaced. And so, you know, we were able to do this and follow the height of land, which was not necessarily always well defined, but we were able to do that and follow the height of land out to the rim above Galahad Point. So that was pretty nice. It took us like an hour and a half to get out there. Again, checking out that beautiful forest. And then right at Galahad Point, the descent route, it's a pretty neat little gully that you go down. And it's parallel, the gully, the drainage is parallel to the rim, which is just to the west. And so you get this really deep notch gully that drops off with this little rim ridge right to the west of it, you know. And it's a very compact topography in there. And we poked around. We dropped our camping gear. No, I'm sorry. We poked around there and to find the actual descent and realized it was this gully. So we then started down, and it's just a great little walk down through the Kaibab Torweep and then into the Coconino.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a lot of people I shouldn't say a lot, but, you know, numbers of people go down here, cavers that are trying to get into the caves
right.
in Mordred and Merlin Abyss,
yep.
and then also the climbers who want to go to Excalibur,
yep.
right? So, you know, there's a nice little trail through there, and you know, you have to find there's a little bit, some down climbs that you have to do, and it was just really straightforward to get down. And I noticed that because, I don't know if it was October or what, but there was a fair amount of flow in here. We'd been in here before, and it was somewhat dry in those earlier visits. And this time there was a lot of flow and lots of birds floating around and
oh, wow.
flying around. And I remember distinctly finding this dead flicker, woodpecker, on the, you know, just lying on the slab of Coconino. And it looked like it had recently died because it was intact. It hadn't been, you know, scavenged at all, or it wasn't desiccated.
Wasn't there some bird flu going around at that time, and you would find dead birds that just had died of internal, you know, problems?
Oh wow, I didn't know that. So maybe, well, that would certainly explain it, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Huh.
Interesting. Huh. Well, okay. I didn't know what that had happened, how that had happened, but. You know, you always wonder. You see so many birds and flying around, and you rarely see their carcasses,
right,
you know.
Right.
And, I mean, these animals have to die, and I guess they're just consumed by scavengers very
mm-hmm.
quickly,
yep.
you know. And, of
yep.
course,
that's right.
because they're so small, the bones just get crushed up and go through the digestive tract, so
mm-hmm.
you don't even see a skeleton remaining, right?
Right.
So, anyways... Just interesting observations, and so then we got down onto the Supai, and left the flow in that little drainage there that was so comforting.
How was the locust?
You know, we didn't have problems with it.
Okay.
I mean, it's there.
Yep.
And but I think, you know, particularly here this route, there's a good use trail.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And at least there was in 2016,
mm-hmm.
and. And we didn't have any problems with a locust there. And then when we followed the Supai bench around the south side of Excalibur and Guinevere,
yep.
It was similar. I mean, there's locusts
yeah.
here and there, but you can avoid it all, right?
Yes. yes.
Pretty much all of it. And it's fairly straightforward, right? So, yeah, it wasn't much of a problem, really,
Good.
At all.
Okay.
So yeah, anyways... We headed around to the south side of Guinevere and dropped our packs basically due south of Guinevere.
Okay.
And so the objective was to climb King Arthur and Guinevere. So what we did then was we hiked a little bit farther to the west, northwest, to the base of the climb up King Arthur. And at that point, we parted. Maybe I didn't even tell you that Art was on this trip. I don't remember saying
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
beginning.
No. Yeah, you both went up.
Okay.
You know, from,
so anyways, yeah.
yeah.
So Art decided he was just going to stay below and you know, on the underneath a nice pinion somewhere, and
okay.
then he would watch me climb King Arthur, which is what we did.
Okay.
And it's fairly straightforward. It's just a third class scramble.
Yeah.
With some nice you know, nice little boulder moves here and there. A couple of Indian ruins on the summit block, you know, the cap rock of Kaibab. But really, you know, really nice summit to get, and I was very happy to get it because we had wanted to do this the previous spring and, you know, saw it from a distance and decided it was just way too much for us at that time because of the heat. And, you know, I noticed that I wrote down all the people who had climbed or who were registered
Oh,
in
uh-huh.
the register on King Arthur.
Cool.
And it's pretty numerous. There's a lot of people there. So, you know, a fair number of hikers are getting out to look after these summits, including people you don't recognize anymore, you know. I mean, it used to be in the 70s and 80s when you found a cairn and opened it up and there was a register, you'd recognize everybody.
Mm-hmm,
you'd know
mm-hmm.
all the people, right?
Right.
If you had never actually met them, you'd seen their names before in the registers
yes.
on other summits, right?
Right.
And so But, you know, nowadays it's an enlarging fraternity, and it's interesting to see people putting all the names in there, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But that was nice. So I got to put in one of the Art Light registers. Mm-hmm. I think I talked about these earlier, and
yep.
I think I actually suggested you talk to Art about his project to make all these registers and put them out on the summits.
We've done some emailing back and forth about that, yes.
Yeah, that would make a really good story. So,
yeah.
So I got to put one out on King Arthur and then headed back down. It was kind of uneventful. I got to wave down to Art, you know, down below. I could just see him laying under the under his pinion. And so I headed back down and back to our point there, rejoined him, and then we walked back over to Guinevere, and then I think I forgot to tell you that we had dropped our pack at Guinevere, right? And
okay.
So the plan was to stay there for the night, and then go up Guinevere the next day, because we didn't want to try and do all this in one day, because we probably would have been too pressed for time, so...
Okay.
So we had dropped our packs at the south side of Guinevere and then walked around to the northwest with just day packs. And so we returned to our packs and set up our campsite there. It was still pretty early, like 5:30, but you know, still getting close enough to to night that you want to get ready. And so in we had an uneventful night there, and then the next day Art again elected to stay below while I went up Guinevere, and Guinevere was actually a kind of a more engaging summit. There's some actual, you know, you have to do some actual scrambling there, and it turns out, I mean, there's a couple of described routes on the internet or in the Tomasi guide, and you know, they're almost technical in their difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
But if you poke around on the summit block and walk all the way around it, you can find basically easy walk-ups. So,
yeah.
You know, that's what I did. I wasn't about to try my luck on these parallel chimneys without any ropes. And,
right.
and so I just continued around to the west and found, you know, a really easy walk-up on the west end. And then when I came down, I actually went around the north face and found an easier walk-up over there, although I didn't go up it. I could just see that it went up.
Mm-hmm.
And so it always pays to poke around, you know, and look, if you have the time at least, to look for optional routes. I mean, the biggest, the best example of that I think we talked about was when Art and I climbed Berry Butte, and which is down off the Grand View Trail. And I think we may have talked about this, but we'd gotten the beta from Jim Ullman about the route he went up with, I think, the people from the Northern Arizona Hiking Club.
Mm.
And it was actually a somewhat technical route. We poked around on the bottom of it, Art and I, and couldn't find anything. And we were really dismayed because we thought we weren't going to get up this thing. And then we walked around to the other end of the butte, and there was just a third-class walk-up, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It just – if you poke around, you can often find a somewhat easier route than the one you're looking at. So,
right.
So anyways, it was a fun climb to do. And, again, I replaced the register. This one had even more people in it. You know, it's like 30 people had recorded their names in this register. So it was pretty numerous people. And I'm kind of surprised that there's that many people going to some of these summits, because you don't seem to see those numbers of people signing into most of the other summits, right?
Oh,
so
okay.
I guess it's just because of the access. It's relatively easy to do. You can do it as a day hike,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. And maybe that's what's motivating people. But so anyways, I came back down and rejoined Art, and we, you know, then headed back, passed around the south side of Excalibur, and of course I'm scoping out the climbing routes and hoping that someday I can get back there to do that. I still haven't done it.
That's a challenge.
But maybe next year. You never know.
Yeah.
And then we ascended back up to the rim and followed our route back to Cannabinet's cabin. So that was pretty nice. A couple days, we got a couple summits, and it was very satisfying to finally get out to these two summits. And, you know, I have to say that when I was a youngster in college, and I think we've talked about this, but I spent many hours in the special collections of the library at University of Arizona in Tucson, and they had in there a set of Harvey's notes,
right.
Photocopies, but it was you know, very, very strategic for me to be able to access these notes and get the details of Harvey's climbs and his hiking, you know, and at that time, because there was very little information available on approaches and routes and things like that, and I do remember that the climbs of King Arthur and Guinevere and Elaine, and it may be because of the connection with you know, the Camelot and King Arthur and all that, but the descriptions of those hikes that Harvey took really stood in my mind, you know, when I read those.
Right.
And so it was a lot of fun to go out 40, 50 years later and actually finally repeat the things that Harvey had gone up, you know, in the mid-60s.
Yeah.
So a lot of satisfaction there. So.
Nice.
So anyways, the next objective then was to go after Elaine.
Okay.
Castle. So we got in the car and we drove. When we left in the morning, we camped again at Galahad Point and then went back to the car. And so then the next morning, when we got to the car, we drove back. Drove back north along the roads there to the place we'd parked earlier in the year to go out to Elaine Castle, and. You know, that route is, again, it's another exercise in walking through the forest. You have to, you know, follow your compass, but be very aware of the height of land. And I know this time, the first time I'd gone out there with Art, we had no problems, and we got very straightforward. We got out there very, very quickly in short order without any sort of sidetracking or meandering.
Okay.
But this time I got a little confused at the start, and we got off the high point of the ridge. It was no big deal because we could just walk west, and we knew we'd eventually, you know, connect with the best route. But again, it's not, you know, when you're not on the high point of the ridge, then you have to deal with topography because you're going down and then up around drainages, across drainages, and you also, when you go into these drainages, you start to encounter the locust that you were alluding to earlier, etc. So it was a little bit disappointing because we couldn't follow the exact route that we'd found earlier in the year. But nonetheless, it was no big deal. We finally got on track and followed the height of land out. It's really neat when you're out there on this particular point because you can see the drainage of Big Spring Canyon, which is the headwaters of Shinumo Creek, essentially,
right.
Forming or to the north of you as you're walking out the ridge to the west, and you start to see views into this canyon, and initially there it's just a relatively minor canyon. It looks that way. It's not very deep, but then all of a sudden, when you get far enough, you know, when after you've essentially passed the point where the canyon has then dissected down deep enough to start to intersect, the Coconino, then you start to see, you know, in dramatic relief, the canyon there to your north and through
right.
the trees. It's not a continuous view because you've constantly got the forest there. But just interesting to be able to see that that feature develop, you know, as you walk parallel to it. But anyways, I digress, and we got out to Lancelot Point, and the plan then was to just drop down and head out to Elaine, which, you know, we'd been to in the previous spring. We tried to get up there and walked out to the south side of it, and I started up, and it was just too much for me at the time because of the heat. So, but this time was no problem. It was a very straightforward walk down, and we followed the Esplanade Supai platform around to the south side, and then again just headed right up to the top. And Elaine is another summit with a nice, nice entertaining summit experience there, trying to just work your way up through the ledges and find a way up to the summit. So it again, it had there were a number of people who had signed into the register, and it was interesting to kind of review all that, and fairly uneventful. So nice. It was pretty exciting that we had been able to pull off these two hikes, and then Elaine following that, and get three new summits in fairly quick order. So the rest of the part of the rest of our plan for this trip was then to go do Juno and Jupiter. So we drove back to the backcountry office. Well, actually we drove back to the main highway, and because it was late in the day at this point, we went to the spot I've talked about with you on the boundary road that heads out to Saddle Mountain Overlook,
right,
just north of Nankoweap, Point Imperial, rather.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And we had a nice campsite out there that was off the main road, on a smaller road that I think it was probably the road that goes out to Marble View. No, it wouldn't have been that one, but one of the small forest roads, probably that they used to use for fire control, and we spent several nights over the years driving into that on that road a little ways and finding a nice spot to pull out and camp. And we went back there to try and find that spot again, and they had expanded the road significantly, so that I think for fire control,
okay,
they had expanded the main road, and essentially they had cut down all the forest on both sides of the road, and out for about, like, I don't know, 30 meters, something like that, from the road, you know? So it's a huge open zone parallel to the road, and basically they kind of eliminated that road. So we couldn't even find it, and to pull off into the woods. So to make a long story short, we poked around and tried to find a place to camp, and we wound up going to farther to the north along Highway 89, where the Arizona Trail crosses.
Okay.
And there's a nice parking lot there, and we just camped right outside the car, you know, and there was nobody there, so it was. It was a nice evening, but it was interesting because evolution, right, changes things. You have a favorite camping spot, and then the Park Service goes in, and for various reasons, you know, fire suppression or fire control, they kind of eliminate that, so you got to come up with another option. But it worked; it was fine, and so the next morning we headed back into the North Rim area. And went to the backcountry office to try and get a permit for Juno and Jupiter.
Okay.
And while we were there waiting to get the permit, Art started feeling pretty ill.
Oh wow!
And he got the dry heave. So we kind of thought that it probably didn't make sense to take off on a trip into the canyon with him not feeling at his best. Right.
Right.
So. So we decided at that point to forego Juno and Jupiter again.
Okay.
And then head back to Phoenix. So which we did. So we took our time and drove back north, and interestingly we went to the Navajo Bridge Visitor Center, which I had never been to.
Okay.
You know, so this is of course the visitor center that's associated with the new bridge.
Yep.
And a very, very spacious and big place, the visitor center. But I was kind of disappointed. I thought they might have all sorts of river running exhibits and things like that, but they didn't have much in the way of that. It was just a big bookstore, really.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, we poked around there because I'd never been to that visitor center, and we walked out on the old bridge. And I said, well, how about I go down and try this sheep trail, which is a little trail just north of the bridge.
Yep.
And so you sound like you're familiar with it. And
yeah.
I had read about this
in
Harvey's notes and in various places. And I think he mentions it briefly in his Trex book. And And I thought, well, it's got to be an easy hike, you know, because they run sheep down to the river here.
Mm-hmm.
And Art said, well, he said he had done it many years ago.
Okay.
I think with Barbara Zinn at the time.
Okay.
And so he said, I'll just stay here at the bridge, and you can run out and do it, right? So I said, okay, this sounds like a fun little option. So I did, and you know, it was interesting because I initially walked across the bridge, and then followed the rim around to the north, and eventually you get to the head of this canyon. So it's about a half a mile north of the bridge, I guess.
Right.
And there's a road that comes in from the highway.
Yep.
From 89A, and so it's a dirt road, you know, and that takes you to essentially the top of the drop off that goes down into this side canyon, and I was just amazed at how much garbage was everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was really amazing at the amount of garbage that had been dropped out there. Not, it wasn't like a garbage dump, but it was like people go out there with a couple of beers, you know, and they throw the bottles and the cans out, and over generations this starts to add up, you know. And the wind blows the dry cans around, and anyways, there was garbage everywhere. But you know, I will say that there was some benefit to that, because once I started hiking down this route, it sounds like you're familiar with it. It's not straightforward. You'd think it's called the Sheep Trail. You'd think it would be very obvious and easy.
A couple switchbacks will be right down there. This will be easy.
What's that?
A couple of switchbacks will be right down there. This will be easy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And there may have been that trail construction in there at one point, but a lot of it is missing now. And so, quite honestly, it was by following the garbage train that I could find the way to the proper descent, you know. I mean, I'm being a little facetious, but it certainly made things easier to see, oh, well, there's a bunch of, you know, candy bar wrappers and bottles and cans over here, so this must be the route.
Mm.
And indeed, that's the way it kind of unfolded. So anyways, I worked my way down, and I was so surprised, because there's some fairly challenging third class climb arounds that you have to do, and if you just poke around and look for the route, it all becomes evident, right? But it's not a sheep trail that the sheep could just jauntily trot down. So,
right.
Yeah. So it was a surprise, but at the same time, that's so fun to run into that, you know, to encounter something that's totally contrary to what you expect, and you have a great time trying to sort it out. So, anyways, I worked my way down the trail, and you know, it's fairly complicated, but it works out, and you follow the garbage and you get down to the river, right? And so it was really nice, though, because you know, I don't get down to the river too often on these hikes.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that you and I have differently. You know, you start your hiking from the river, you're always there,
right, going up
at the end of the day or in the morning, and you know, I can sometimes go on these hikes and we never pass close to the river, and we just see it from a distance if we're lucky. So, but it was really nice to sit down there and relax, you know, because it's always cool right next to the river, and nobody came by on, you know, in mid October, 10th or 11th of October, and nobody floated by, but I only stayed there an hour.
Hmm.
And Art said he could see me from the bridge, but I couldn't make him out because I could see the bridge and I could see specks of people on it, but not able to differentiate who they might be. So anyways, it was a lot of fun, a good ending to a relatively short trip, because again, you know, this is another one of these butchered routes that I had read about when I was a youngster, and actually getting to follow the route and do it even later in life was just a very fun, relaxing experience. So, yeah. Anyways, that was pretty much the end of that trip. We went back to Phoenix, and we actually did some hikes in the Matazals after that, just day hikes. Once Art felt a little bit better, but that was our Grand Canyon experience for October of 2016.
All right. Then what did you do?
Well, then I had another year drought, right? It wasn't until October of 2017 when I was able to organize the next trip.
Okay.
And sometimes February of 2017. So I got the wrong notes here on the in front of me, so now I've got the right ones. Anyway, so this was in February of 2017. Now, we've talked, I think, before, Tom, about the Granitica Symposium that was held in Flagstaff in, what was it, 2016 or 15, about Grand Canyon climbing.
Yep.
And I gave a presentation at that. And when I came back to Vancouver, some people in my office, I mentioned that I'd given this in Flagstaff, and they said, well, why don't you give it here in the office?
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I said, well, I can do that, you know. And so I did that, and one of the guys who attended, it was only like 30 people there in attendance, right?
Mm-hmm.
But one of the fellows that attended was a fellow named Mark Coleman, who was working for the Geological Survey at the time, working in our office as a student assistant.
Okay.
So he would be a geologist that would assist the senior geologists out in the field during the summer. So Mark had worked in the Yukon with a couple of the geologists in our office that previous summer, and kind of established his bona fides with the GSC, you know, because we're looking for certain types of people who love the outdoors and can handle the rigors of, you know, being outdoors in mountain environments and
mm-hmm.
really bad conditions and dealing with wildlife and all those things. And so Mark had established himself as a very solid geologist amongst our staff.
Okay.
And I hadn't really met him myself because we do different kinds of geology. But he was in attendance at this talk. And so I gave the talk, and he sidled up to me afterwards and said, boy, that was great. He said, I love that. You know, that kind of hiking in climbing in a wilderness setting, you know, where you're way out on your own, and
mm-hmm.
and he said that's really appealing to me. And he said if you're ever interested in having somebody go with you,
huh.
I'd be happy to go along. And so I start talking to Mark, and you know, he's like 28, super fit, and you know, a 5'11" climber.
Okay.
So I'm thinking, man, I found my sugar daddy, you know. And of course, I wonder what he'll think when he hears that. But anyways, no, I mean, I thought I told him, sure, you know, let's do something. And over the, you know, because he's in our office, I would now seeing him fairly commonly. And over a couple of weeks and months, you know, he became quite persistent and wanting to go do something. So I thought, okay, well, let's go try something. We'll go try to climb Hutton Butte,
okay,
which is the peak that I had wanted to climb so strongly since, like, I first saw it in 1976, and saw it from the bottom, not from the rim, but from the bottom. And it was kind of the outstanding summit that I wanted to climb. And so I suggested to Mark that we go for this, showed him on the map, and he was really game for it. So that was the start of this trip. We had planned to bring Art, you know, not bring him, but to have him accompany us.
Right.
So the three of us were going to do this trip into Nanquip and Quaggan Creeks. So it eventually expanded from a trip to just do Hutton into also include Ehrenberg Point and Malgosa Crest.
Okay.
And two other summits. And Ehrenberg, I had tried once before a long time prior, but not expecting to get up it at the time, but I'd been right up to the base of the technical climb. And so the plan was to do all three of these, right? So I flew down to Sky Harbor Airport there, and I met Mark, and he flew in from a different spot. I think he was in Montreal at the time. I can't recall. But we met there, and then we went to the local car rental desk, and I had booked a Nissan Rogue, right, which is a nice kind of SUV, and
okay.
Which I'd had before. But when, you know, we checked in, and they said, okay, just go downstairs and they'll show you where to get your vehicle. So we went down, and the guy said, well, just pick anything out of there, out of that row. And there were these Jeep Renegades with four-wheel drive, right? And I thought, well, that could come in handy, you know. And so we said, what about this? And the guy said, sure, anything you want in that row. So we took the the Renegade, and that proved fruitful, as you'll find out. Hmm. So we got the vehicle, and we headed over to Art's, and Art gave us some equipment to take. He gave us some climbing gear. He gave us some registers to bring. And he had made a hiking stick, which he gave to Mark. Art makes hiking sticks that are really nice quality. They're well balanced and well crafted. And I mean, I've used them for 25 years since he gave me the first one in 95, I think it was. I've used many different ones, but so he gave one to Mark, and Mark kind of looked at it like, well, what do I do with this, you know? But he admitted that once you get off trail in the canyon, having these sticks is really, yeah, really useful. So,
that's right.
But unfortunately, Art decided that, you know, because of the weather forecast, he didn't really want to go along on this trip.
Okay.
And it was supposed to be kind of, you know, relatively poor conditions. And so, but of course, since I've come all this distance and organized this whole thing, I can't back out on it, right?
Right.
And so Mark and I said, well, okay, sorry that you can't go. We understand, right? And so we headed north up the Black Canyon Highway, and then went to Cliff Dwellers, and where we wanted to get a room for the night, and they were closed up there. And we actually poked around in the back and knocked on some trailer doors, and managed to rouse the cook. Well, he wasn't asleep or anything, but it was still in the early evening. But he said, "I'm sorry, I have no authority to open up." He didn't have the key to open up a room if he could. So we said, "Okay, well, we beat it back over to Marble Canyon then." And fortunately, there was still somebody up there, and they gave us a room for the night. So that was nice, and to have that sleeping there.
Yeah.
And so in the morning, you know, we got up and headed to House Rock Valley, and drove the road in. And unfortunately, particularly for Mark, because this was his first time to the Grand Canyon, the forest, the pinyon pine forest in the vicinity of the head of the Saddle Mountain Trail was just totally burned. So the last couple of kilometers out to the end of the road there had all been burned, and then the hike up the road and down into Saddle Canyon, that area had all been burned too. And it was really kind of unfortunate because it's such a beautiful area, and there was even a fair amount of the burn heads up towards the saddle, you know, getting up into the Ponderosa Pine. So, but you know, kind of again, it tells you. Is an example of the temporary nature of the landscapes that we hike through.
That's
you
right.
Know, these burns come in and take out the vegetation, but surprisingly, you go back a few years later and you can see it, you know, starting to recover. So,
yeah. Takes a while.
It takes a while, especially for these, you know, big magnificent ponderosa pine forests.
That's right.
To get to climax, but. You know, they will come back in some form or other, so it's nice to know that. So, but anyways, we started up that trail, and it was kind of hard to follow actually, because you know, when the forest duff was there, you would have a natural trace where the trail is that you could easily follow, but without that duff gone, you know, this obvious line through the woods is not as evident, so you had to be more careful with route finding. Believe it or not, I mean, on this stretch of trail, and particularly once you started to climb up to the saddle, once you leave the drainage of Saddle Canyon and head south up the slope through the Ponderosa Pine, heading for the saddle of Saddle Mountain, the trail was really hard to find in there. Plus, it was also covered with snow in a lot of places, so. You know, we had to take our time, but we got up to the the saddle, and you know, it's kind of neat to be with somebody who is seeing the Grand Canyon for the first time, you know, and especially somebody like a geologist who appreciates, you know, the geological magnificence of it, and somebody who's so interested in outdoors and whatnot. So, you know, it was great to see Mark's, you know, enthusiasm for the hiking and the whole experience. So that was just a lot of fun to watch that. So anyways, we started down the trail, and the plan was to just go down the Nanquip Trail because we had heavy loads. You know, we had ropes, you know, we had 265-foot ropes with us.
Wow.
For Hutton, because we knew it was a big climb, and a full rack, and our climbing gear and helmets, and you know, the full pack. So it was a heavy load, and we took our time going down Nanquip and got down to the campsite there at the bottom of the trail, and set up for the night. And so the next day, then the plan was to do Ehrenberg first. Because it was the farthest west up Nanquip Creek.
Okay.
And then we would come back and then climb Hutton second, and carrying our gear up, you know, all our full packs up to the base of the Hutton climb, do the climb, and then we would come back down to the base of the climb, put our full packs on, and go south down into Quaggan, and then we could go down quickly to Malgosa.
Right.
And do that summit. That was the plan, right? So we set up our tent, our flies in the campsite there, and had some sprinkles during the night, so it was a little ominous, right, and kind of portending, I guess. And so in the morning we got up early and put our full packs on, broke camp, got our full packs on, and then hiked up to the drainage that comes down from the north side of Hutton. And we dropped our packs there at a campsite that we've used several times now, and then took our climbing gear and headed up Nanquip to the west to try and go up Ehrenberg. So the easiest way, the best way to get up to Ehrenberg is to hike up Nanquip till you're more or less due north of the summit of Ehrenberg. And at that point, there's a huge boulder there, and people call it the Boulder Camp because you can camp under it. And then you can go straight up from there and climb the Taos slopes and through to Pete's and then work your way up to the climb on Ehrenberg. So anyways, we got up to close to where this boulder camp is located, and it started to rain. And there was even at this point down in Nanquip, there was a burn, a fire burn.
Oh, wow.
That had gone through some of the pinyon juniper down there in the creek bottom. Now, I don't know if that was just embers that had blown over from the big fire at in the Saddle Mountain area.
Right.
It could have been, right? But yeah, there was a burn. Evidence of a burn down there, and it had been fairly recent, like within a couple of months, I think we decided. So, but anyways, it started to sprinkle, and you know, we're looking at each other, and then we said, well, we'll wait it out, you know. And so we found a little boulder. It wasn't the nice big boulder because we hadn't gotten that far up the valley, and we found a little boulder, and we're kind of sitting under it, and the rain just slowly started getting heavier and heavier, and the time's ticking by, you know. And so at some point, we basically said, I guess we're going to have to pull the plug on Ehrenberg, you know. And so, you know, that's what we did. And we kind of turned around and kind of begrudgingly walked back down the canyon to where we had dropped our gear. And it's a nice little campsite, so we you know, put up the tarp to get out of the rain, and we were just kind of chatting because we figured we could still do Hutton the next day,
right?
And then continue with our plan, just having dropped Ehrenberg from the agenda. So in fact, in the afternoon, it starts to clear off. I mean, you can see blue sky, a little bit of sun poking through, and we're going, all right, man, all right, we're in Fat City because we're going to get hunting tomorrow. And so we went to bed with those positive ideas in the mind. And, of course, in the middle of the night, we start to hear the sprinkles on the tarp, you know. And it never came down heavy, but it was kind of indicating to us that the weather was still, it hadn't cleaned out. It was
unsettled.
Still unstable, and we had to be concerned about it. So, but we didn't decide to cancel the climbing, fortunately. So we started up and carrying our packs up the drainage, and I've talked about this hike up before. It's a little challenging, and if for future hikers, if you stay to the east of the drainage, you're much better shape because it's a much more open slope there. But eventually, we got to the top of the pass that goes between Nanquib Creek and down into Quaggan. So it's a pass essentially between Swilling Butte and Hutton Butte.
Okay.
And Hutton just kind of rears up magnificently to the east of you, and Swilling is more of a bigger base of topography, and it's kind of set back from the pass a little bit more, so it's not as imposing. But Hutton from this pass looks very imposing because you're right there at the face, and you can see the full north face of it, and the west face, and it's very, very neat spot to sit in, right? And so we get up there, and we're jazzed because it's not raining. You know, it's fortunate. It had by this time in the morning, it was all relatively dry. And so we dropped our backpacks at the saddle and took our climbing packs up to the Hutton Butte. And you know what, Tom? I have to say, I think we didn't bring our backpacks up. I think at this point we had decided we were going to skip Malgosa.
Okay.
Anyways, whether the decision was made down below, no, I'm pretty sure I carried my backpack up. That's right, because it was a full load. I remember that now. Yeah, we had our full packs up to the saddle,
okay,
and then we dropped our packs there, and then went started up the climb. And now the climb was, it's super exciting. I don't know if you've done it.
No.
But, again, it was something that I had dreamed about for 40 years.
Mm.
And I knew, people had done it. Jim Ullman and I think Ken Walters. I'm not sure who else accompanied him. Joe Kirschvink, I think, had done it. Jim Kirschvink, I'm sorry. Joe is his brother, who's an academic.
Okay.
Jim Kirschvink and Jim Ullman had done the first ascent, and I mentioned to you in a discussion long ago that I had seen them from the Nanquib Trail when I was climbing Burke Point. I had seen them doing the first ascent of Ehrenberg, and they did Hutton shortly after this. So it was kind of an interesting experience to finally get to the base of this climb. And And of course, Mark's a no nonsense climber, and he said, "We got to get moving on this, And so we put our racks together, we put our climbing shoes on, and we started up. And the first pitch, it was just kind of scrambling. It was up, third and fourth class type climbing that over blocks and ledges to the base of the main climbing. And I'm not going to go into the details, but there were two really difficult pitches, or significant pitches, not really difficult. They're like 5'8", or
okay,
hard 5'7", maybe, the crux. It's hard to say. But really out there, as far as leads go, I mean, you really, Mark had, he had slim protection.
Okay.
There's a couple of fixed pins, and he got a couple of cams in that weren't particularly good. But then, he managed it just fine, and it was really exhilarating to be up on this climb and watching him do the leading. He was doing the leading, right?
Okay.
And that was the plan that we had. I just wasn't climbing at that level to be able to lead this stuff. So we did the first two pitches, and the crux pitch, I'm happy to report, I managed to do it without any tension, without any pulling. I didn't come off or anything like that, although I started to at right at the crux move, which is an interesting little layback on a thin layback on a really, really steep face. But anyways, it went up and went really smoothly and quickly, and nice. We were really super excited because we've done the first two pitches. The third pitch is just a horizontal traverse, and the last pitch is relatively short. So we put the kept our gear going, transferred the gear back and forth. I gave him the stuff I'd cleaned, and we switched the ropes around, and he led off on the third pitch, which is just a horizontal traverse, very straightforward, but pretty exposed.
Mm.
And then at the end of that traverse, there's a climb up a gully / chimney, which again is all easy holds and whatnot. You know, you have to put some protection in, but it's not too difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're right at the final pitch, like 25 feet below the summit, and Mark's all geared up. We got the racks all set up, and he starts off on the final pitch, and there's like a small little head wall to start, and then there's like a 15 to 20-foot traverse, and then the final 15, 20-foot of vertical to get you right to the top. And so he's casting about there at the base of that final 20 feet, and the rain starts.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. And, you know, he put in a solid effort. I have to give him that. You know, the problem is that there's not much protection there.
Right.
And, you know, he was a little leery about making these moves on unprotected rock in the rain.
Right.
Right. And so it's limestone, the red wall limestone. So, in some places that's very edgy.
Yep.
And sharp.
Sticky.
And gives you really good holds. But in other places it's very smooth.
Yeah.
And water worn. And this particular face, you know, there's runoff that comes off the top of the summit of the peak and comes down this face. So those sharp edges weren't in abundance. And Mark tried and tried. And unfortunately the rain started to get in heavier and heavier, and so eventually he said, "I'm going to bail," and I said, "Good idea," you know. So he came back down. He worked his way back down, and then we had to reverse the climb. Well, we rappelled it. We didn't reverse the climb, but you don't go down. The rappel route doesn't go down the same route as the climb. It parallels
right.
it, but it's you essentially rappel down from the end of that traverse, and then you traverse back on the second rappel back to the west to get back to the original line. So, yeah, and it was very impressive because the first rappel took up most of our 265-foot ropes,
oh,
right?
Wow.
So basically it's 150, 160-foot long rappel, and you're kind of happy when you get to the end of that and you see you've still got a few feet of rope left. But But so anyways, it was kind of a disappointment, but this is what you run into when you're in the wilderness, right? You have to go with the flow.
That's right.
And adapt.
That's
and
right.
So disappointing for me, although I mean of course when you're retreating and the adrenaline's running, you know, you're not really thinking about that aspect of it. It's when you get back to your camp and you realize, oh well, it's not going to happen, etc. So at this point, we decided, well, the best thing to do is to just retreat back down to the camp we'd been at the night before, and then kind of leave the canyon. We didn't think
okay.
we could get to Mount Gosa at this point.
Right.
And the weather wasn't cooperating, so we did. We went back down to the bed of Nanquip, to the camp we'd spent the night before, and I think we actually hiked back down to the base of the Nanquip Trail there,
okay.
and camped there for the night. And of course, in the afternoon, the sun comes out and dries everything out, you know. And but you know, I'm sitting up there, and as we're coming back down from the hike, I was thinking to myself, you know, if I had just been 15 minutes faster hiking up to the base of the climb, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we had gotten up 15 minutes earlier,
right?
You know. If all these ifs, if we had done this, if we had done that, we would have had the opportunity to do that final 20 feet in the dry, and we would have had the summit. But it just didn't happen. So, anyways, it was a major disappointment, and for me, but, you know, try not to let it get me down. And
yeah.
And so we just decided at that point that we would basically retreat out of the canyon. And I suggested that we do a climb over in Marble Canyon, which Mark was great with the idea of, right?
Hmm.
And so the next day we camped at the campsite down there, and then the next day we headed up the trail, the Nanquib Trail, to our vehicle. And interestingly, because we were hiking separately, basically, you know, we would meet up here and there, like at the top of the Red Wall, we met up, and Mark was for the most part ahead of me.
Okay.
For most of the hike out, and you know, these are heavy packs, right?
Mm-hmm.
With all the climbing gear, and so but towards the end there, just below the saddle on the trail, you know, we were resting together, and oh, that's right, because when at one of the points, the point that goes that heads out to Marion Point, where the trail crosses that ridge,
okay,
I stopped and Mark said, "Look, I want to hike out there, and we can onto Marion Point." So
yeah.
he would get a summit, right?
Okay.
And so I said, "Yeah, take Art's register, right? And you can put one of the Art Light registers out on the point as well, right?" So, because we had brought three registers for Ehrenberg, Quaggan, and Malgosa, and we were still carrying them. And this was one way we could get rid of one of them. So. You know, Mark headed out to Marion Point, and I continued up the trail ahead of him. And, you know, the thinking was that he would catch up with me eventually,
right,
and then we would continue down. So when I got to the saddle, I waited for him for like 20 minutes or so, and half an hour. I don't remember exactly how long. But it was starting to get a little late, and I thought, well, you know, I'm going to head down, start heading down the trail, and he'll catch up to me in short order. So I did that, and I walked all the way to the car. And he still hadn't caught up to me. So at this point, it was pretty much dusk when I got to the car.
Okay.
And I should say it was dark, okay? And Mark hadn't caught up yet. So I was pretty apprehensive, didn't know where he was. And I knew where he was. He was obviously behind me. But you know, what had happened or anything like that. So anyways, I eventually turned the car around so that I could face the headlights up to the south, and then I turned the car on and put the headlights on, and after a few minutes I heard a yell, and so I realized that I had, you know, that he had seen the lights, and so fortunately he was able to use those headlights to come down. And you remember I was saying that that the trail was really hard to follow even
right.
during the day,
right?
Because of the burn. And so it was, you know, triply difficult for a guy who'd never been on it,
right,
to do it in the dark. And he had a headlamp and whatnot, but it was still difficult. So
yeah.
It turns out that he had decided that it was a waste of his time, and he was going to just camp for the night where he was, which was like a kilometer short of the car.
Oh, gosh.
And at that point, that's when I turned my lights on, and he saw the lights, and he said, okay, I can figure it out now.
Right.
So he came back down. You know, he continued down, and we rejoined at the parking lot. So interesting day, interesting
cool.
day, and interesting trip. So it wasn't quite over yet. We decided then to head back to Marble Canyon, try and get another room, and which we did. And so it was kind of, you know, nice to get into a nice bed and shower up and clean up and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so what I suggested to Mark was that we could do this butte that I had attempted in, I think it was 78. I'm not quite sure exactly when. We'd have to go back through the notes and look it up. But I had attempted it with Bruce Grubbs and Bill Murphy at that time. And I had found a route down to off the rim for this butte. Anyways, I got to tell you where it is first. And we call it Sazenascat Butte because it's a big butte, about a kilometer or maybe half a kilometer square on the surface.
Right.
So it's a big mass that's separated from the rim by a prominent notch in the Kaibab and part of the Torweep. And it's basically due north of the 49.9 mile red wall route.
Right.
Along the river. Okay. So there's a feature on the rim called Sazinascat, which is presumably a Navajo name, and it's essentially a downdropped a fault block that is downdropped relative to the rim to the east.
Yes.
And also to this butte to the west. So there's faults on either side of this downdropped block of that's called Sazinascat. And I'm not quite sure. I've never gotten a formal definition of this from a Navajo, but what I've read online and talking to people is it means something like lots of loose rocks or something like that. Okay, but anyways, I've always called this butte Sazinascat Butte, and I had seen it so prominently from many places in the canyon when I was younger that I really wanted to climb it, even in the 70s. So at that time, in 78, I had scouted out the route down through the Kaibab and Coconino, and it goes down the fault scarp that's on the east side of the Sazinascat downdrop block on the rim.
Right.
And so you can take a road pretty much all the way out to there, Navajo reservation roads,
mm-hmm.
And you have to follow the map. You have to be very cognizant of where you are.
Right.
But you can get out there fairly straightforward, and then drop down from the road to this break. Well, I tried it in 78 with Bruce and Murphy, and we only got down essentially to the Esplanade before we had to turn back because we were out of time. But this time with Mark, I figured we could give it a whole day from the rim and see what happened. And, of course, about 6 months after I attempted to do it with Bruce and Murphy, Bruce and Murph went back themselves and did the first ascent of Sazinascat. So I knew that it wasn't a hard climb, but it was supposedly technical. They used a rope on it. So Mark and I decided we would give it this shot, and we drove out to the end of the road. And driving out these reservations roads, it's east of on the east rim of the river canyon.
Yeah.
Is always a tremendous place. It's a tremendous experience because it's so remote to drive out these roads, which are very poor quality, and then you get into such magnificent settings, with the river dropping right below you, and then, of course, the canyon rising up above to the Kaibab Plateau, and we're here at the end of winter, right? So there's still snow on the plateau. It's all just magnificent vistas, but I was a little worried about the road, right? Because it's a lot of mud on the reservation roads to get out to this this climb. But anyways, nonetheless, we decided we were going to give it a shot, and we got to the end of the road there pretty much in the late afternoon. So we built ourselves a nice camp, and Mark, thinking ahead, he noticed there was a little breeze, and he built a nice walled structure surrounding our tarp so that it would cut the wind if it arose, which it surely did in the night. And so fortunately, because we had this well thought out construction, it made our night much more peaceful. But in the morning we got up and we started down, and you got a couple choices at the top of the descent. You want to get into the West Gully, and there's actually some trail construction, a couple of switchbacks at the top. Why? I have no idea, because you get down far enough at the base of the Coke, there's no way you can get sheep or anything else down the final drop there. So, but Mark and I worked our way down, and following the route that Murphy and Bruce and I had worked out in 78, I think it was. And we got to the base of the Coconino, I had this image in my mind of what the final drop down through the Coconino was like, and my recollection was perfect. It was absolutely perfect, spot on. It very exposed, and you have to just step down over some blind ledges where you can't see anything, and reach around with your foot, as you're stepping down, and try and find a hold, and then you make another step, and you're at the top of a talus cone, so really fun and nice to know that my memory in that particular case had not failed me. So So,
nice.
So anyways, we hiked, at this point then, you can hike down to the Supai and hike around following the Supai, the Esplanade, for quite a distance. And there was some nice water pockets out there on the Esplanade sandstone, at the south end of the ridge there that you have to hike around. So, we followed the Esplanade to the north after we went around the west side of Sassy Nazcat. And, it's kind of rough going, through the talus boulders and whatnot. But eventually you get to the base of the gully now that goes up through the Coconino to get you to the notch that's between the butte and the rim.
Okay.
All right. I hope you can follow the topography here. And, it's a straightforward gully, right? Nothing challenging to it. So we get up this and it's kind of midday at this point. And, you know, the clouds are starting to build up, and it wasn't threatening at that point, but you're mindful because I was worried about the mud on the roads, right? And so anyways, Sassy Nazcat it's a really neat butte because it has very steep drops right from the top of the Coconino down, right, all the way around. It goes way down, like almost straight down to through much of the Supai. So you have these big cliffs, and yet there's a nice bench you can walk around at the top of the Coconino that just brings you around much of the east side and the north side of the butte. And on the north side, there's two main gullies that dissect the north face. And we first went to the second gully and looked up that. And decided, you see on the map, if you look at the map topography, it looks like it's a gentler angle, right?
Hmm.
And so we thought that it would be more likely that it would be an easier route up the second gully. But in actuality, when you got there and you looked up, you know, it wasn't, there were more bands that presented themselves than you would expect. So we went back to the first gully, the eastern one, and started up that. And at one point, we were able to work our way through a lot of these bands in the Kaibab, and at one point we get to a cliff, and we thought, well, yeah, this is we can protect this, and we can probably put something in. So we did that. Mark led it. It was very quick, just like 30 feet, something like that. And then that was it. It was just a straightforward walk hike up to the summit.
Okay.
And then we had to hike another half a kilometer or so to the south to get to the main summit. But you know, at this point you're looking straight down on the Colorado River, and it's like you're looking down river. All you can see a lot of the way down through Marble Canyon, almost, you know, way down towards the junction with the Little Colorado. It's a tremendous view up there.
Yes.
And there was a huge cairn too, so that was kind of interesting. Kind of, you know, fun to be up there because I'd tried to do that I'm saying it was 78. That's my recollection. So it had been almost 44 years, right, since I'd tried that with Bruce and Murphy, and I finally got to get up it after all that time.
Nice.
So there wasn't a register per se with no names, with any names in it, but we, you know, added a rock to the cairn that was there.
Cool.
and started back, right? And so interestingly, we got back down to our climb, and I we rigged a rappel, and I went down first. And when I leaned out over the cliff, I happened to see a bolt that we had totally missed on the ascent.
Oh, wow.
And it turns out that Bruce Grubbs, and when he climbed the first ascent with Murphy, had put this bolt in to protect that pitch, and we missed it on the climb, but we rappelled past it on the descent, and I took a picture of it and sent it to Bruce, and he said, yeah, that was the bolt we put in there. So it was kind of fun to talk about that after so many years. But now, interestingly, I want to finish here with a description of our return, because you know, it was getting kind of late in the day, and we were worried about the weather. And so it was starting to spit on us. And, you know, I mentioned that the clouds had been building up. So we were kind of nervous about the roads. And so we started back, and we're trying to hustle. And we got to the to the notch between Sazanacket Butte and the rim, and you know, we had come up from below, right, through the Coconino, and we also were facing the return across that really awkward, difficult talus slope, and so, but I was looking at the ledge we were on, and I said, you know, it looks like we can follow this ledge horizontally. This is at the base of the Kaibab, or Torweep, and at the top of the Coconino. It looks like we can follow this ledge horizontally for quite a ways to the south and bypass all that talus that we crossed down below, right? And so, you know, we said, well, let's give it a shot, right? So we put our packs on, and we followed this ledge, and believe it or not, it goes all the way. In fact, it narrows down at one point to like a foot wide.
Huh.
With 60 or 70 feet of exposure, but beautiful handholds, right? So you're just sitting there shuffling along this really tiny little ledge, and I'm reminded of Thank God Ledge on Half Dome, which is on the west face route on Half Dome, which is you go up like 22 pitches or something like that, and then there's this pitch called Thank God Ledge, and it's a horizontal ledge. It's about 100 feet long. And it narrows down. It narrows down to like 6 inches at one point, and it's much more difficult than this thing we did.
Right, because it's granite.
But it was very, you know, very reminiscent of that, right? And so, so we shuffled across that, and you eventually get to the end of this ledge. You can go around a corner, and then it just disappears, and you'd have to do a major wrap. But we were able to backtrack a little bit, and then work our way down the talus. But well past the area that had given us such challenge in the morning, right?
Nice.
So it was a big savings, a huge savings. And that's the way I would go back there. Mm. Now I would go straight up to that little ledge and then follow it across towards the butte.
And, Jim, so, how do you spell the summit?
Well, it's two words. And S-A-S-E and then Nasket, capital N-A-S-K-E-T.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's how it's spelled on the topographic map,
okay.
Right? But again, I would need to connect with a Navajo who might know more of the details of this area, what this might mean, refer to. If you know of anybody you're talking about, you can mention it to them, and I'd be really thrilled to know what they might say. So, anyways, we followed the at that point, then we worked our way back down to the Esplanade and took advantage of those water pockets because I had to walk out there quite a little ways to the edge of the cliff to get this water, but I'd run out, you know, and so it was really nice to have it. And then we retraced the route back up through the Kaibab, Coconino and Kaibab, to the rim and back to our campsite at the car. Now, when we got to the car, it was pretty much dusk, and it was starting to spit, and even more seriously, you know, because the clouds have been building all day. So we said we better get out of here tonight while we have reasonably dry roads. Indeed, if they're even still dry farther to the east, you know, because we didn't know what had been happening over there. It could have been downpours all over the place. So we got into the Jeep, and we started east, and it was pitch black. And I remember, you know, I was driving the car, keeping track of the mileage, and Mark was sitting in the side seat with a topographic map and a compass. We were using the compass on the GPS in the vehicle, right?
Okay.
Because we could follow the route that way, and it didn't show the roads, but it showed the direction.
Yes.
And so, you know, the three of us, me with the odometer, Mark with the map, and then the Jeep with its GPS heading telling us where north was, we worked our way in the dark back along these roads, and we only had one mix-up at one of the reservoirs there, and we didn't go around the reservoir far enough before we headed off, and we caught our mistake quite quickly, fortunately. And it was kind of gripping, to tell you the truth, because you're out there, and, I mean, of course, you know, any time we could have just shut the car down and gone to sleep, right? But we were worried that the rain was going to come in and make these roads impassable. And as it was, there were many places that had experienced some rain that day because they were wet.
Mm-hmm.
And they had gotten wet since the day before. And so we, you know, were slipping and sliding all over the place on some of these roads. And So the final thing here is we did make it back to the highway, and, you know, hurrah, great, you know, accomplishment, and it felt very satisfying. And went, so we drove into Flagstaff and got a hotel there. And then the next day, I went to one of the local car wash. I think it's called the Flag Car Wash, I think. And we drove into a stall there to, because I wanted to wash some of the the mud, dirt off this car, you know. It was unbelievable how much mud came off this vehicle. And
yeah.
It took me like an hour using the wand and just throwing quarters into this machine to finally get the car looking presentable.
Nice.
You know, you're not supposed to take these rental cars off roads, right?
Right.
And here we had driven, you know, 80 miles or so across the mud of the Navajo Reservation, and that stuff gets so hard, you know, so quickly, that we were down there like chiseling it off with our rock hammers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd squirt it some more, and then chisel some more, and eventually, you know, we finished, and there was like a berm of dirt around the car,
right?
You know,
in
the parking, in the
and the owner of the car wash is shaking their fist, going,
"Yeah,
it says no muddy vehicles."
Yeah, well, I didn't see that sign.
Yeah.
Anyways, it was a kind of a fun ending, and I'm really glad we got to do that climb together, you know. So
nice.
So yeah, Mark got two summits, you know. He got Sassy Nasket, which is an informal butte, and then he got Marion Point. So, you know, he had a good first trip to the canyon, and then I finally got to tackle one that I'd wanted to do for quite a while. So
perfect.
Yeah, good trip.
Very nice.
So sorry about the it was kind of a long day today, I guess, wasn't it? So,
no, it's all right. We did good. We did good.
Yeah.
That was make sure I get this right. February of 2017.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where do we go from here? What's
Well, yeah, the next trip is back to the North Rim again, in October for yet another try on Juno and Jupiter.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll talk about that next time.
Okay, that sounds good.
Cool. All right. Well, with that, this will conclude part 33. I'm kind of jumping ahead. Is this good? Have we covered this ground? Do you think,
have
Jim? Is there anything else you want to add to the material you just talked about?
Well, not right now, Tom. I'm probably think of something later, but you know, I've given a pretty good rendition, I guess, in my mind. So
yeah, this is good.
Yeah, I'm happy with the way it came out. So
okay, excellent.
I just want to say, you know, it was such a lot of fun doing that climb with Mark. I mean, I really, you know, came to respect him even more because of his level-headedness.
Nice.
And it's important to make that point, right? So that people know the record, right? So,
yeah.
Anyways.
Excellent.
Of course, I say that about all the people that I've climbed with multiple times, right?
Well, that's good.
If they're not that type of person, you don't go back with them. Somewhere.
That's right. All right, and you don't mention them to start with. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent. Well, this will conclude part 33 then of Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday. It's July 24th, 2022. And Jim, thank you so very much.
Thank you for the opportunity, Tom. Really appreciate it.